We're reading from Joshua chapters 7 and 8 this morning, and that's on page 155 of the Church Bible. But the Israelites acted unfaithful in regard to the devoted things. Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zimri, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of them, so the Lord's anger burned against Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Aven, to the east of Bethel, and told them, "Go up and spy out the region." So the men went up and spied out Ai. When they returned to Joshua, they said, "Not all the people will have to go up against Ai. Send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it, and do not weary all the people, for only a few men are there." So about 3,000 men went up, but they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries and struck them down on the slopes. At this, the hearts of the people melted and became like water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord, remaining there till evening. The elders of Israel did the same and sprinkled dust over their heads. And Joshua said, "Ah, sovereign Lord, why did you ever bring this people across Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say now that Israel has been routed by its enemies? The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this, and they will surround us and wipe out our name from the earth. What then will you do for your own great name?" The Lord said to Joshua, "Stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have lied. They have put them with their own possessions. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run because they have been made liable to destruction. I will not be with you any more unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction. Go, consecrate the people. Tell them, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. That which is devoted is among you, O Israel. You cannot stand against your enemies until you remove it. In the morning, present yourselves tribe by tribe. The tribe that the Lord takes shall come forward clan by clan. The clan that the Lord takes shall come forward family by family. And the family that the Lord takes shall come forward man by man. He who is caught with the devoted things shall be destroyed by fire, along with all the that belongs to him. He has violated the covenant of the Lord and has done a disgraceful thing in Israel." Early the next morning, Joshua had Israel come forward by tribes, and Judah was taken. The clans of Judah came forward, and he took Zerahites. He had the clan of the Zerahites come forward by families, and Zimri was taken. Joshua and his family came forward man by man, and Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zimri, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. Then Joshua said to Achan, "My son, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give him praise. Tell me, what have you done? Do not hide it from me." Achan replied, "It is true, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw the plunder, a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." So Joshua sent messages, and they ran to the tent So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and there it was hidden in the tent with the silver underneath. They took the things from the tent, brought them to Joshua and all the Israelites, and spread them out before the Lord. Then Joshua, together with all Israel, took Achan, son of Zerah, the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons, daughters, his cattle, donkeys, and sheep, his tent, and all that he had, to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, "Why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today." Then all Israel stoned him. After they had stoned the rest, they buried them. Over Achan they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his fierce anger. Therefore, that place has been called the Valley of Achor ever since. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up and attack Ai, for I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king, except that you may carry off their plunder and livestock for yourselves. Set an ambush behind the city." So Joshua and the whole army moved out to attack Ai. He chose 30,000 of his best fighting men and sent them out at night with these orders. "Listen carefully. You are to set an ambush behind the city. Do not go very far from it. All of you be on the alert. I and all those with me will advance on the city. And when the men come out against us, as they did before, we will flee from them. They will pursue us until we have lured them away from the city. For they will say, 'They are running away from us, as they did before.' So when we flee from them, you are to rise up from ambush and take the city. The Lord your God will give it into your hand. When you have taken the city, set it on fire. Do what the Lord has commanded. See to it you have my orders." Then Joshua sent them off, and they went to the place of ambush and lay in wait between Bethel and Ai, and to the west of Ai. But Joshua spent the night with the people. Early the next morning, Joshua mustered his men, and he and the leaders of Israel marched before them to Ai. The entire force that was with him marched up and approached the city and arrived in front of it. They set up camp north of Ai, with the valley between them and the city. Joshua had taken about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai to the west of the city. They had the soldiers take up their positions, all those in the camp to the north of the city, and the ambush to the west of it. That night Joshua went into the valley. When the king of Ai saw this, he and all the men of the city hurried out early in the morning to meet Israel in battle at a certain place overlooking Arabah. But he did not know that an ambush had been set against him behind the city. Joshua and all Israel let themselves be driven back before them, and they fled towards the desert. All the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai or Bethel who did not go after Israel. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Hold out towards Ai the javelin that is in your hand, for into your hand I will deliver the city." So Joshua held out his javelin towards Ai. As soon as he did this, the men in the ambush rose quickly from their position and rushed forward. They entered the city and captured it and quickly set it on fire. The men of Ai looked back and saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky, but they had no chance to escape in any direction, for the Israelites, who had been fleeing towards the desert, had turned back against their pursuers. For when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city and that smoke was going up from the city, they turned around and attacked the men of Ai. The men of the ambush also came out of the city against them, so that they were caught in the middle with Israel on both sides. Israel cut them down, leaving them neither survivor nor fugitives. But they took the king of Ai alive and brought him to Joshua. When Israel had finished killing all the men of Ai in the fields and in the desert where they had chased them, and every one of them had been put to the sword, all the Israelites returned to Ai and killed those who were in it. 12,000 men and women fell that day, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not draw back the hand that held out his javelin until he had destroyed all who lived in Ai. But Israel did carry off for themselves the livestock and plunder of the city, as the Lord had instructed. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a permanent heap of ruins, a desolate place to this day. He hung the king of Ai on a tree and left him there until evening. At sunset, Joshua ordered them to take his body from the tree and throw it down at the entrance of the city gate. And they raised a large pile of rocks over it, which remains to this day. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the Israelites. He built it according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no iron tool had been used. On it they offered to the Lord burnt offerings and sacrificed fellowship offerings. There, in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, which he had written. All Israel, aliens and citizens alike, with their elders, officials and judges, were standing on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, facing those who carried it. The priests, who were Levites, half of the people stood in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had formerly commanded when they gave instruction to bless the people of Israel. Afterwards, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including the women and children and the aliens who lived among them.
Thank you very much, Chris. Epic reading. Well, look, keep that open. There's an outline of where we're going on the sheets that were handed to you as you came in. But let's ask again for God's help as we look at this. Father God, we thank you again for your word, and ask as we look at it now that it would not remain remote to us, but that your spirit would speak through it in power, that we might know you as you really are, and your plans and purposes for us, and that we might respond in obedience. So we ask for your help now, in Jesus' name, amen. Well, how big a deal is sin? I guess on the one hand, we want to say that sin is a big deal. Like, some of us have lived under the grip of sin for many years, and we know it's destructive, how destructive it's been in our lives. We know the consequences of sin, death, and that's why our Lord Jesus had to die on the cross for us. We also know that God doesn't want us to live in sin, and that we're people who he wants to live godly lives. So in many ways, we kind of think, well, sin is serious. It is a big deal for those reasons. But that said, we live in a world that doesn't take sin very seriously. Take the internet, for example. Two of the major uses of the internet are in the UK are watching pornography and illegally downloading music and film. And I take it that because many people are engaged in these activities, suggests that it's no big deal. It's just what people do. or take abortion. Now, this year, the figures have gone up again. It's no big deal. Now, one of the reasons that people are thinking that sin is no big deal is because they're looking at the human level. So one of the big tests with sin is, does it hurt anybody? That's the kind of the test. So take pornography. Does it hurt anybody? Well, no. You know, the people doing the stuff, they've consented to it. What about illegally downloading material on the internet? Is it hurting anybody? Well, you could say, well, it's hurting those kind of big corporations, but then they're ripping us off anyway. So they know it's happening. That's why they charge so much. Or take abortion. Who have you offended? It's just a collection of cells, people say. So one of the reasons that it's no big deal is because it was just looking at the human level, thinking, does this activity offend anybody? If it doesn't, who cares? Now, one of the implications of thinking of sin this way is that people also think about the consequences of sin in human terms. So again, what are the consequences of watching pornography? Well, none, because I'm not doing any harm. What are the consequences of illegal downloads? Well, I might get fined if I get caught, but everybody's doing it, they're probably not going to bother. Therefore, it's okay. Or the consequences of abortion. I mean, how can that be? I've done nothing wrong. I mean, the tragedy is that even if I have offended somebody, that person is so helpless, they can't do anything about it. So in these ways, the thinking has gone wrong because people are thinking about sin at the human level, not seeing sin in relationship to God. There's no mention of him. And the thing is, we're breathing this kind of stuff in. You know, just as if you ever live with a smoker, you sort of breathe in their smoke. So we live in a world that has a very low view of sin, which can affect the way that we think. And this morning, the passage in Joshua that we're looking at will help us consider the seriousness of sin, because we're going to see it in relationship to God. This will help us to appreciate the gospel, to warn us against sinning, and motivate us to live godly lives. And there are three things that I want us to see, we're going to go through, and then I'm going to finish with three points of implication for us as a church. So the first there on your sheet, sin is serious because it's contrary to God's plan. Let me explain. We've seen so far in chapters 1 and 2 of Joshua that God is all about fulfilling his promises to give his people a land. Chapters 3 and 4, we saw how he got them across the Jordan into the land. And in chapters 5 and 6, God has begun to give them victory over the inhabitants of Canaan, and particularly the victory over Jericho. However, Joshua 7, there's a massive setback because they are defeated in battle in their attempt to take the land of Ai. And actually, over 30 Israelites are killed. Now, this defeat is really serious. And Joshua captures this in his prayer in verse 9. So if you have a look, Joshua prays, "The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this, and they will surround us and wipe out our name from the earth." It was Joshua saying, if this gets out, if news of this defeat gets out, it's all over for us. It's the end. We'll look at the Lord's response in verse 10. The Lord said to Joshua, "Stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen, they have lied, they have put them with their own possessions. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run because they have been made liable to destruction. I will not be with you any more unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction." So God is explaining here that the reason that they have been defeated at Ai is because in verse 11, they have sinned. That's the explanation. And we find out later in the chapter that the chief culprit is Achan, who had taken some of the plunder from Jericho, which was meant for God. So in this way, can you see, sin must be pretty serious, because God is saying, on the basis of this sin, I'm not going to give you victory in Ai. Now, Joshua is saying, well, hang on, it's bigger than that, because of this defeat at Ai, the whole plan is now at risk. But you notice that God doesn't say to Joshua, you're overreacting. Look at what God says in verse 12. He says, I will not be with you anymore unless you deal with the sin. Or in verse 13, God says, you cannot stand against your enemies until you remove it. And so far from God saying to Joshua, you're overreacting, it's all going to be fine, God's saying, no, this is, I'm going to withdraw. This continues. Well, why is God reacting in this way? Because, you know, you could read this and think, isn't God getting a bit worked up over nothing? You know, sure, Achan sinned, we all do. What's the big deal? You know, that sort of thinking. Isn't he overreacting? But God's reaction here is drawing our attention to something very important. And to understand God's reaction, we need to understand God's plan. Listen to these words back in Exodus 19. Can you turn to this? Flick back to Exodus 19 to help us understand more of where God is coming from. Exodus 19, verse 4. So God's explaining what he's done and where he's taking them. He says, you yourselves, Israel, have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasure possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So God is saying that I rescued you from Egypt, this beautiful picture of being carried on eagle's wings. Why? Because he's bringing them to himself to be a holy nation. So the picture is, God's plan is not just to give them a land and sort of plonk them in, but that God's plan is to save a people who will be a holy people and will be his people living in the land. Okay. Now, for this reason, Achan's sin is very serious, because it's totally contrary to God's plan. Central to God's plan is to bring a holy people into the land, whereas Achan is sinning. He's taking Israel in the wrong direction. God's saying, as I look at my people, there's an unfaithfulness here that needs to be dealt with of first importance if you're to live in the land I will give you. You could put it this way. God's saying, my plan cannot advance until you sort this out, because my plan is to take a holy people into the land. So we're not to think of sin as sort of isolated one-off acts. But sin, if you like, sets a direction. And here we're seeing Israel taking a step in the wrong direction. And God is saying, if you go into that direction, then that direction is contrary to my plan, and I will not be with you. I will not give you the land. And you notice how God stresses this. I mean, this is something that we have to get. The way he stresses this is the defeat at Ai. This isn't God saying, look, you're a little bit off course, just need to adjust your bearing a little bit. He's saying, I'm stopping the whole thing because you're going totally in the wrong direction. So that's the first thing. Sin is serious because it's contrary to God's plan. Second, sin is serious because it robs God of his glory. Verses 14 to 22. Well, after this sort of terrifying identity parade in verses 14 to 19, Achan is identified as the chief culprit. And look again what he says in verse 20. Achan replied, "It is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They're hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." So at this point, Achan comes clean as to what he's taken. A beautiful robe, over 2 kilograms of silver, and over 0.5 kilogram of gold. But to help us understand the nature of the crime, we need to understand what should have happened to this plunder from Jericho. So have a look back at chapter 6, verse 17. This is God's instruction regarding Jericho. He says, "The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord. Only Rahab, the prostitute, and all who are with her in the house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury." So it would seem that in the conquest of Jericho, that Israel should have destroyed the robe, and that the silver and gold should have been put into God's treasury. But Achan takes them for himself. Now, Achan's sin can be seen at a number of levels. But at every level, he is saying something about God that diminishes God and makes God less than what he really is. So at a very simple level, Achan is disobedient. He's deliberately disobedient because God said this, he did this. And that way he's saying God is not worthy to be obeyed. He's not Lord. At another level, Achan is claiming a victory that was God's, because the silver and gold were plunder from God's victory at Jericho. Remember, the victory there was victory without a battle, because it was God who did it. And the silver and gold were to go into God's treasury in honour of him. If you like, all of that treasure would speak of the honour and glory and victory of God. Yet Achan takes some for himself. And that way he's robbing God. He's saying, I'm going to take some of the victory of the battle. At another level, Achan is loving something other than God. In verse 21, he speaks of coveting the beautiful robe and the lumps of gold and silver. There's a picture there that something has captured him. Rather than loving God with all his heart, soul, and strength, there's something else which has grabbed his heart. In this way, he's saying that there's something more desirable than God. Still, at another level, there might be a sense in which Achan is providing for himself and his family. Now, these things are valuable. And this way, he's saying that, or implicitly implying that God will not provide for him, that he needs to make his own provision. He's implying that God is not generous, but stingy, that God is not good because he's withholding this good thing from him. It's interesting. Sin always does this. Sin always says something about God. And the shocking thing is that Achan, of all people, ought to know better. Because like Achan, he has lived the goodness and generosity of God and the power of God in a very special, concrete ways. If you think about it, this family, God had led them through the flooded Jordan by his power. He had promised them a land. He had given them defeat at Jericho. He was going to give them the land. He was going to give them the plunder for Ai. Yet his sin denied the truth of God. He's saying, God's not to be obeyed. He's not the winner of my battles. He's not worthy of my affection. He's not generous. He's not good. And one of the things we thought about in the introduction was how people tend to think about sin at the horizontal level. You know, how sin affects other people. And sin is an offence against other people. You know, that's because we're made in the image of God. But here we see the seriousness of sin in terms of how it dishonours God. Because it robs God of his glory. The sin says something untrue about God, which makes him less than he is. It's a personal attack on God, if you like. So that's the second thing. Sin is serious because it robs God of his glory. Thirdly, sin is serious because it results in God's judgment. From verse 23. After Achan's confession, the plunder is retrieved from under his bed. And then verse 24, have a look. Then Joshua, together with all Israel, took Achan, son of Zerah, the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons and daughters, his cattle, donkeys and sheep, his tent and all that he had, to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today. Then all Israel stoned him. And after they had stoned the rest, they burned him. Over Achan, they heaped a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Then the Lord turned from his fierce anger. Therefore, that place has been called the Valley of Achor ever since. If we want to know how serious Achan's sin was, look at what happened to him. He and his family were stoned to death. The penalty for sin is death. And notice that Israel isn't administering her own justice here. This is God's judgment. This is God's fierce anger that is being administered by his people. And this makes sense if we think about what we've learned, what we're understanding about sin. Because if sin is just I'm just offending human people, then all I fear is a human response. But if sin is an offence against God, then I've offended God. And there's a penalty that comes from God, and that penalty is death. And if we're in any doubt about this, look at what happens to the city of Ai in chapter 8. If you have a look at verse 24. When Israel had finished killing all the men of Ai in the fields and in the desert where they had chased them, and when every one of them had been put to the sword, all the Israelites returned to Ai and killed those who were in it. 12,000 men and women fell that day, all the people of Ai. I mean, the striking thing here is the totality of the destruction. All of Ai was destroyed. Although it's not particularly explained here, the reason is because of their sin. Tom was explaining last week, and if you're away for this, you need to sort of listen to that. But that one of the striking things is how slow God was to punish Ai for their sin. How patient God has been with the Canaanites. Because he had previously warned them to turn from their sin. But their hearts were set on sinning, and therefore they were destroyed. So look, if we want to know how serious sin is, look at what happens to a whole city full of unrepentant sinners. They're destroyed. That is the penalty of sin, and that is where sin leads. So sin is serious because it results in God's judgment. In this way, we're to understand sin in relationship to God. It's contrary to his will, his purposes, to save a holy people. It robs him of his glory. And for that reason, since sin is an offence against God, there's no surprise that it incurs a punishment from God, death. Well, as we conclude, I want us to think about three implications of the seriousness of sin for us. The first is, we are never going to understand the gospel unless we've understood how serious sin is. Like, Jesus' death will never be good news for us unless we see how serious sin is. And the Bible's conclusion is that we've all sinned, we all deserve death, yet God sent his Son to die in our place. Or put it another way, each of us deserves to go through that terrifying identity parade, where we are totally exposed, even the secrets of our hearts. Yet Jesus took that for us. And as a church, I mean, it motivates us to think, well, this is why Bradford needs the gospel. And even if it's unpopular, we have to teach the seriousness of sin, don't we? Because that's the only way people will understand the good news of Jesus. Second, and this is probably the biggest thing for us, is that we need to heed the warning here that God does not show favoritism. Because one of the striking things, I don't know if you noticed in Chris's reading, is the parallel between Achan and the king of Ai. Because they were both killed, but they were both buried in the same way. Did you notice that? So if you look back at chapter 7, verse 26, it says, over Achan they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. And then 8:29, and they raised a large pile of rocks over the king of Ai, which remains to this day. So in other words, there's these two piles of rocks, one to mark the grave of Achan, one to mark the grave of the king of Ai, and they were both memorials of where sin leads. And the striking thing is that God shows no favoritism, because Achan wasn't able to hide under the umbrella of Israel. You know, it's like, whether you're an Israelite or not, one day sin will be exposed and the penalty for sin is death. There's a warning here. I think that's why at the end of chapter 8, Joshua renews the covenant between God and Israel. And it's interesting, if you look at verse 34 in chapter 8, it says this: Joshua read all the words of the law, and notice that he read them to everybody, so all the people, all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it's written in the book of the law. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we saw how God uses his power to keep his promises. But the shocking thing to get here is that God will use his power to keep his promise to save, and God will use his power to keep his promise to judge. Okay. And if you remember, you know, when they went through the Jordan, they left those 12 stones to mark how all Israel had passed through. So those stones were a memorial to speak of the fact that God will use his power to save his people. But the two piles of stones on Achan and King Ai spoke of the fact that God will use his power to keep his promise to judge. And God wants us to know this as a church, not to breathe in what the world is saying about sin. So he's warning us of the dangers of pursuing sin, because this is where it leads. Third implication, and the final one. The seriousness of sin helps us to think a little bit about the issue of guidance. You know, as we ask the question, what does God want me to do with my life? Because it highlights the fact that central to his plan is that he wants us to be holy. Listen to these words of Titus chapter 2. Jesus Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good. Paul is saying here, the reason that Jesus Christ saved us is that we would be his people who are holy, who are eager to do what is good. That's God's will for us, to be this people. But listen to what one Christian writer says on this. He says, very often when people say that they're having problems about guidance, what they're really faced with is a problem about obedience. The issue at stake is whether we will walk along the paths of righteousness in which God will lead us. What he's noting here is that he's saying, look, the greatest obstacle is not ignorance. It's not like, well, what does God want me to do with my life? I'm not sure. I'm waiting for him to sort of make that known to me. His comment is, our biggest problem is obedience, issues of obedience, disobedience. In other words, in the areas where God has specifically addressed, in those areas specifically addressed by the Bible, we're to obey God. And so, I take it, it can't be the case that God is happy for us to pursue our dreams and plans if we are neglecting holiness. I mean, how that doesn't make sense. And it's even less true that we can say, look, God is happy for us to pursue our plans and desires and goals and think that that is God's plan for us if we neglect issues of holiness. Because the whole point of that stopping them at AI was to say, you can't, my plan is to make you holy. Therefore, this is the thing that we need to work at. So you could put it this way, God is building a holy church. And it's a trinity. God's will for us is that we would be a holy church. And the call of the gospel is be holy as I am holy. And this is of first importance to him. That's why he died for us. And it's a call to obedience.